Thanks, and I'd like to tell everybody thanks for hanging in there. I know some of these sessions, not any of these presenters, but some of these sessions can go pretty long, but I do appreciate your patience. Today, I'm happy to be here and talk about the National ALS Registry. This is a brand new registry that kicked off a couple weeks ago. So really, what I'm going to talk about today is a birth of a registry. And I want to acknowledge my co-authors, Oleg Mirovov, Wendy Kay, and Marcel Sanchez. And like everybody else, we have no relationships to disclose. First of all, just curious, how many people have ever heard of ATSDR? Okay. So I appreciate your trying to say ATSDR. A lot of people mangle it. But, you know, we are a federal agency, and we love to use acronyms. So anyway, we're a federal agency under HHS, and we are a sister agency of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, and we're located in Atlanta. And really what we do is we focus on environmental health, but specifically toxic substances and how toxic substances affect human health. And you can see down here, we do a lot of different things, health assessments. We have various surveillance projects. Registries, we have a number of different registries within ATSDR, health studies, emergency response, and so forth. So first of all, before I get into the National ALS Registry, registries come in all shapes, sizes. You know, you can have a registry that's pretty much just a line listing of names that maybe include various diseases or a disease or maybe an exposure. But really, there are two different types of registries in our business. There's exposure registries, and a good example of this is ATSDR. We have the Trimlite Asbestos Registry. And so, obviously, the exposure is asbestos. And then we have disease registries, i.e. the National ALS Registry. And, you know, the purpose of a registry is to take this information, analyze it, give it to researchers, and really do something good with it. Any surveillance system or registry, you can collect data until you're blue in the face, but unless you take that data, turn around, and analyze it, and look for risk factors or whatever it is you're looking at, you might as well close shop. So, you know, we do collect data, and we are going to provide this data to researchers once we get a sufficient amount of data under our belt, and I'll go into that in a few minutes. So, probably the question on your mind is why ALS, why an ALS registry? That's a very good question. And let me just start by saying ALS is a terrible disease. How many of you guys know anybody with ALS? So a couple. One of the reasons we're trying to do this is to quantify the incidence and prevalence of ALS. Right now, we have no idea how many cases are out there in the U.S. There are estimates, but these estimates are largely based on small geographic registries, such as hospital registries, and then that data is extrapolated out to the U.S. So what we're trying to do is to really determine how common is this disease. And then also, we know that death certificates are useful up to a certain point, but death certificates are notoriously wrong in a lot of cases, especially the underlying cause of death. So we hope that this registry will help us clarify how common is is this disease. So we didn't just sit down one day and say, let's come up with a registry, let's create an ALS registry. Any registry, no matter who does it, you have to do your homework, you have to do your due diligence, and there's a lot of work that goes into creating a registry. And this one is no different. The purpose of this is just to show that we did do our due diligence. We funded some pilots back 2006 to 2009. And really what we're trying to do is to test the feasibility of creating a national ALS registry using large national data sets. And I'll explain which data sets I'm referring to. But the outcome of this was that we did create an algorithm that we feel is a very good algorithm. And once we apply this to these large national databases, it really it gives us a high positive predictive value. In other words, we can pinpoint a high percentage of ALS cases within these databases. This is just preliminary data that we haven't even published yet, but we are going to try to publish this data soon. This was from our pilot work, and you can see here Medicare, Medicaid, and VA are the databases that we used to run our algorithms against. And as you can see in this first row right here, just from the algorithms alone, we came up with approximately 16,000 cases of ALS within 2001 to 2005. So we feel pretty good about it. Again, we feel good about, we came up with cases that are clearly not ALS. So this is one approach that we're using. I'm going to talk about a second approach that we're using. But this is the real reason of why we're creating a national ALS registry. Congress passed the law, the president signed it back in 2008, and this really gave us the push to hit the ground running and create a registry. And without any kind of congressional push or law, many of these activities are very difficult. And we were fortunate that money was tied with this as well. So, of course, it takes money, personnel, resources to undertake a registry of this magnitude. So what are the purposes of the registry? And this came straight from the bill, really to try to describe the incidence and prevalence of ALS. We want to know who gets it. You know, how does it affect Caucasian Americans versus Latino Americans versus African Americans? We just really don't know that. But probably the most important thing in my mind for this registry is we're going to examine risk factors. You know, Lou Gehrig was diagnosed 71, 72 years ago, and we still to this day don't really know what causes ALS. So in my mind, this is the most critical piece of the registry. And the way we're going to do this is we're going to have people who come and enroll in the web portal take very brief, short surveys, surveys on occupational history, military history. There's been mentioned in the literature that those who have a military service history are twice as likely to get ALS. Why is that? We don't know. But hopefully this registry will be able to either verify that or counteract it. But other things, smoking history, chemical exposures, head trauma. There's been a lot in the news lately about head trauma possibly leading to ALS. So, you know, we're really going to kind of dig down and look at all this data to see if there are common factors, common threads that may pinpoint which way we should be looking at ALS research. Okay, so we're in the present now. As I mentioned, we have a two-pronged approach that we're taking. Unlike cancer, and probably most of you know since you're in public health, cancer for the most part is a reportable disease. So if you're diagnosed with cancer in most states, if not all states, the diagnosing physician would report that back to the state health registry where it goes into their cancer registry. If that were the case for ALS, we would have had a registry 10 years ago. But because ALS is not a reportable disease, we had to come up with creative strategies on how do we capture ALS cases around the country. So the first approach, as I mentioned, is we're using large national databases and we're applying algorithms to these databases to try to tease out ALS cases. And as you can see down at the bottom, just these three databases alone represents about 90 million Americans. So we have a very sizable chunk of the U.S. population. But we also know that not everyone is going to be eligible for Medicare, Medicaid, or not everyone is a veteran. And so for that reason, we had to come up with a method to try to capture those people who fall between the cracks, so to speak. And so what we did is came up with an online web portal. And so this web portal, as you can see here, it launched 21 days ago. And right now we have about 1,500 cases to date, which is, you know, we're pleased with that. We're trying to get the word out. We're trying to work with our advocacy groups and certain patient groups to get the word out that, hey, this registry is now in effect. So we're making good progress, but we've got a long ways to go. So what I just told you is kind of summarized here in this chart. On the left-hand side, large national databases, we apply the algorithm. And what this does is it puts people into three different categories. They're clearly not an ALS patient. They're a possible patient. We just don't have enough information to make a determination. Or they're clearly an ALS patient. For those that are potential ALS patients, we keep them in our registry. And as we get subsequent years worth of data from VA, Medicare, Medicaid, hopefully this data will allow us to make a determination one way or the other, yes, they're a case, or no, they're not a case. If they're a case, then they go straight into the registry. And then on the right-hand side is the web portal, as I mentioned. How does a person get into the web portal? Well, they go to our website. They answer some validation questions. And depending on how they answer these questions, it'll either put them in a true category classification or a non-ALS classification. Now, I just want to mention the validation questions that we used are the same validation questions that the VA used about 5 years ago when they created their own VA ALS registry. And they determined that their questions were 94% effective, meaning that they captured about 94% of the true ALS cases. We saw no reason to reinvent the wheel, and so we're using these validation questions. Registry rollout. One problem or challenge with the registry is, how do you keep it fresh? How do you keep it, how do you promote it? You know, we know that patients are diagnosed every day with ALS, whereas the World Trade Center Registry, which ATSDR helped launch, there was just a finite amount of people who were in Manhattan on that day. And so obviously we can canvas, and they did canvas the area and came up with about 71,000 people in their registry, but that's it. So, but ALS is different. Every day new cases will be diagnosed, and every day a newly diagnosed case won't necessarily know about our registry. So we got a challenge ahead of us, but we're doing things such as press releases, obviously taking advantage of social media, working with our advocacy groups, MDA and the ALS Association, who represent about 90% of ALS cases around the country. Very important partners for us. And then going to conferences such as APHA, neurological conferences, and so on and so forth. We developed a big battery of products, and hoping that people would take these and learn more about ALS. So just want to briefly show you a couple screenshots. When you go to our website, www.cdc.gov/ALS, this is the main page you'll see. As you can see up top, you have to create an account to enroll in the registry. We've got a lot of different products, useful links on the side describing what is ALS and some of our partners. And then once a person creates an account, they'll be able to take the surveys, which you can see here, update their account, change their passwords. We've got videos, we've got webinars on there describing what ALS is. And we're trying to make it almost like a one-stop shop so that you can find out anything and everything about ALS while at the same time helping us populate the registry. The surveys, just wanted to show the survey page. Again, the surveys, these are things like smoking history, military history, head trauma, things like that. They're very brief surveys. Because of OMB, we had to keep them very brief, not to overburden the patient coming in. We ask these people to take surveys 1 through 6 one time. Once they do it, it's grayed out. The last survey down here is a quality of life changes survey. And really, we want patients to take that twice. That tells us a lot about disease progression. So if you get ALS, sadly, most people deteriorate very quickly. They go from walking to all of a sudden a wheelchair, to a breathing tube, to feeding apparatus, and it goes downhill very quickly. So we're hoping the registry will be able to follow the disease progression of ALS patients. We've got a continuing education module. Physicians are a very important, critical piece of our targeted effort. Physicians are largely our mouthpiece, especially neurologists. Once they diagnose someone, we hope that they'll be able to pass information along. The ATSDR has this registry. So we created a continuing education module on there. Last slide, upcoming plans. We're trying to really hone in on how complete are our data. And the way we're doing this is we're funding several state and metro-based surveillance projects. And they'll go out and do active case findings. And they'll go out to a state and contact every neurologist in that state. We'll get that data, and we'll be able to cross-reference it with what's in our national database to show us, are there gaps? If so, how can we tighten this up and make sure we capture more cases? Exploring the feasibility of creating a DNA bank that goes along with this, and a brain bank that goes along this with this, which is tissue, tissue banking. And then, as I mentioned earlier, we want to share this information with researchers once we have at least a year's worth of sufficient data under our belt. So I know that's a lot, but that's pretty much our game plan for creating the national registry. And we've got a booth here, so I invite you, if you want to learn more about it, stop by. It's right across from the CDC booth. And that's it. Thank you.
I'd just like to take a minute to thank all of our presenters for the fascinating presentations. We do have a few minutes that we can open it up if anyone has any questions. And I'd like to personally invite any of you that want to attend the epidemiology section. We'll have a social at Marlowe's, which is about a block over on 16th and Glen Arms this evening for any epidemiologists. So I'll open that up to any questions. Absolutely.
Have you, AL, since it's mainly a fatal disease, are you going to validate it by going to death certificates and seeing what fraction of death certificates are you picked up in your registry? I guess you have to wait a year to do that.
Right. So that's a very good question. Every year we're going to run our database through the National Death Index. And so that'll tell us, you know, who died. Because really we want to maintain a database of living ALS patients. Now we'll be able to do a lot with mortality data. You know, we can do analyses and studies on that. But yes, we do, we are planning on running it through the National Death Index yearly.
Well, that would give you the mortality of the people you discovered.
Right.
But if you went to some of your cooperating states,
right,
you might be able to get the IDs of people who died of ALS and do a sort of a capture.
Right, and we do, exactly, and in our state-based and metro-based surveillance, they are going to use the capture-recapture method. So,
I'm a PI for this registry, working with Kevin. Just a bit of clarification for your question about death certificates. There was an interesting challenge working with death data, because in the US we use ICD-9 for morbidity reporting, but ICD-10 for mortality. And interestingly enough, ICD-10 was a step forward regarding many diseases. Unfortunately, with regard to ALS and other motor neuron diseases, it was a step back because ICD-10 does not have a ALS-specific code versus ICD-9 does. So death certificates would not be a reliable source of information. You literally have to go to every record and look whether a person had ALS or another MND.
Any other questions for our presenters?